Welcome to Book Me Podcast, sponsored by Nimbus Publishing. I'm Lindsay Glode Raininbird. Join me as we journey through contemporary Canadian literature, reading as much as we can and chatting with authors, illustrators, and other bookish folk, celebrating our dynamic, diverse, and vibrant national literary scene as we go. So grab a snack, get cozy, break that binding, dog-ear those pages. Let's dig into it. Today, we're chatting with Nimbus Publishing Managing Editor, Whitney Moran, who has been mentioned so many times by authors, she's felt like an unofficial guest in the room with us. So we just had to make it official. In this episode, we're going to get a peek behind the editing scenes with Whitney and look forward to what we're most excited to read. We've got plenty of books to put on your radar and fill up your TBR, so let's get into it. Welcome, Whitney.
Aw, thank you. I've been a fan of the podcast, so I just want to say you're doing a great job.
Thanks. All right, so tell us a little bit about you. How did you find your way to publishing? Was it something you always wanted to do?
I found my way to publishing in a very roundabout way. Like, I feel bad for anyone who's looking for like a roadmap because I feel like there isn't one. There are some publishing certificates you could do and things like that, but I did a master's in English literatures, thought I would be a professor maybe, but I started here as just like an entry-level in-house editor. It's actually been 11 years when the podcast airs. And then a few years later, the position opened for what was then senior editor. And I think I cried every day that first year. It was really intense. I had so much to learn and I had imposter syndrome like you would not believe, which we will talk about later because one of our books gets into that. But I love everything about it. Honestly, I love being around writers and creativity. And I've had a lot of jobs where I wasn't able to be creative and I knew that wasn't going to work for me. So I'm just so excited almost every day when I come to work. I honestly can't imagine myself doing anything else.
I love that for you. What is your job as managing editor?
Well, like most people who work in sort of medium-sized independent publishing, I have a lot of jobs. So I'm the managing editor, which means that I manage our lists. Publishing is split into two seasons, so spring and fall. So that means as things are acquired, which I also do as the acquisitions editor, I kind of plan out our seasons. So because Nimbus is a general interest publisher, I try to make sure there's something for everyone on our list. So because we do everything from like baby board books to adult fiction and nonfiction, like we always want to maintain our core mandate of celebrating Atlantic Canadian stories. But I also want to always push the meaning of that and whose stories are being told and what stories are being told. So typically, I'm working on about 2 years ahead. So like 25 books a season times four. So that's a lot of books. But I also get to acquire books, which means that I'm always on the lookout for projects to commission. If I read a great article and I think this would make a good book, you know, some of the books I'm most proud of have started like that. Rebecca Rose's Before the Parade and Rebecca Thomas's I'm Finding My Talk. So that's really fun. And then also we get a lot of submissions. So typically now we're open for reading periods. So we have submissions come in and I review those along with the two other editors here who I would not survive without. And so we kind of decide what books get to be published, which feels like a lot of power for anyone to have. But it's, I'm really astounded by how many people are writing books and who like push through all that self-doubt and all of that to get to the end. I also do the contracts. So then it's time to sign a contract. I do that. So some publishing houses would have different people doing all of those things. So that's why I have 400 emails in my inbox right now.
With great power comes great responsibility.
Yes. So yeah, it's managing, acquiring, and I also do a lot of editing. So I edit projects as well.
And on the side, you're writing books.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about what it's like when you just find something that really is like amazing. You're like, I have to publish this.
It's so great. It's like, I can't tell someone about it fast enough. Like I've actually run down the hall before. I remember when we used to get submissions by mail. And when Brianna Corscott's first submission came in for She Dreams of Sable Island, I gasped. I ran to the general manager's office and I was like, look at this. Because it was all physical, right? She sent some paper dolls and all these illustrations. And I was just like, and at that moment, I remembered, I was like, I've seen her at the crafters fairs. How did I not put two and two together? And now I don't even know how many books we've done together, maybe seven. And so, yeah, that was kind of like one of those moments where I just felt like, I can't believe this just came to me, you know, and I just couldn't get in touch with her fast enough. So there's also those moments where I'm reading something longer, like a novel, and I try not to get too excited because often what's been worked on the most is like the first 50 pages, the first third of a novel. But when I'm reading a novel submission and I'm just completely captivated, I want to be transported. And that doesn't always happen with submissions because you're not reading a finished draft. You're reading, looking for potential. But that's a really exciting feeling when the gears start going and I start thinking. Like when I'm making lots of notes, that tells me that I'm interested because I'm seeing kind of what my editorial direction would be. So it's just really exciting. And it's something I wish I had more time to dedicate to. And it's usually like really fevered. And I'm like, I have a day to read like this many submissions. But yeah, I usually know pretty quickly if it's something I'm going to really love. And it's just, yeah, it's an incredible feeling. And it's the best part of my job is to give that news to someone when I'm like, we want to publish your book.
Making
and it's
dreams
just
come true.
I never get tired of it.
Has there ever been a moment where you read a submission and passed on it and then later felt regret about that?
That is the editor's curse. Yes. You can't say yes to everything. There's a lot of reasons why sometimes something isn't a good fit. You know, maybe you just don't feel like your publishing house would be the best home for it, which I think a lot of people think is like maybe like just a nice way of saying no, but it's really true. Like, because we're trying to sell books, if our sales reps think that a book doesn't really belong in our list, it's going to be hard for them to sell it because people aren't expecting that. So that's why I'm constantly trying to like expand what it is that Nimbus does, because when those projects come along that are maybe doing something really different and exciting, I don't want it to be like, well, it's not a Nimbus book, because I want that definition to be always dynamic and changing. It is really hard. And I know everyone's got their like books too that they made an offer on that they didn't get, and that, you know, I will still support those books and buy them when they come out and tell everyone about them, because to me it's sort of like, you know, it's all about the book being in the world, and I think books find the right home, but it can be a little bit heartbreaking sometimes.
And then sometimes they might find their way back to you.
They do sometimes, yes. I'm a reader first, so I feel like as long as I get to read the book and, you know, buy it and tell people about it, then, you know, that's the important thing.
So do you have any little tidbits about the books we had on this season? Little behind the scenes?
Behind the scenes. Well, I do have like a list here of some of my favorite non-Nimbus books and then some Nimbus books that I think would appeal to you if you either read that book or are interested in it. Because we do so many books and I find it hard to, you know, pick favorites. But I kind of thought, you know, this might be a way of celebrating some of our books that are sort of like, if you read this big five book that's, you know, been shoved down your throat all year, then you might like this little book that we published.
Some comparisons.
But we also, you know, we had Nosy Parker by Leslie Crew was on the Globe and Mail bestsellers list. So, I mean, our books do get out there and they do get seen. But, you know, sometimes it's hard to compete with the marketing machine of the big five. So the first one that I wanted to mention is Now Is Not the Time to Panic by Kevin Wilson. I absolutely loved every second of this book. It's so funny and heartfelt, and it's like awkward teenage love and art making and like so many things that I love reading about. And the writing is just incredible. And we actually have a book coming out in June, which I think would be a really great, if you read this book and you're like, yes, I need more of this. We have the great privilege of publishing the new book by Leo McKay Jr. He is most well known for the books Like This and 26. He was shortlisted for the Governor General's Award. And this is his first book in quite some time. So basically, it's similar to Kevin's book in the sense that it follows these two kids, their high school age. And so I'm just going to read a little bit about it so you can get a sense of it. So it follows two social outcasts as they navigate their traumatic pasts. The worst moment of Sam's life was captured on video and shared across the internet for all to gawk at. This is something she has in common with Robot, who just wants to move past the mistakes he's made, if only his small town would let him. When the two meet in a high school music class, they start to find their way to each other. Music might offer a way not only forward, but forward together. If Sam and Robot can overcome the echoes of the moments that made them infamous. The past reverberates in ways we don't expect in this new novel by Giller Prize shortlisted author Leo McKay Jr. From family secrets and old relationships that resurface, to the tape loops that endlessly replay private moments of trauma and despair, what comes echoing back travels back and forth in time to get to what's true, with humor, humanity, and the healing power of music. So, I mean, tell me you don't want to read that.
That sounds good. So if you like Now Is Not the Time to Panic, then read
What Comes Echoing Back. Also, for fans of books like Tomorrow, 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 which I also loved, but I didn't put on my list because we had so many books to talk about. Just any books that are about like two kind of misfits finding each other and trying to navigate through something as complicated as high school and making one mistake and having like everyone know like your deepest, darkest, shameful secret. And Leo is actually a high school teacher. So he's like on the trenches of this kind of bullying. So he really has a sense of like how kids that age interact and the things that they care about. And I'm sure that these students are based on like many students he's had over the years. And yeah, the writing is really beautiful. And it's also like for anyone who likes reading about music, there's a lot of really beautiful music writing. Robot, you know, plays the guitar. Yeah. So it's got a lot of depth.
And if you liked the 90s before the internet sort of thing, then I also really like Decoding Dot Gray for that. I love that she it was like before smartphones and before all this, and she had the pager going. So
yeah,
like I hate when people talk about text or they have like the pictures of the text in the book. I'm like,
I flip through a book and there's pictures of texts, I won't read it. I'm like, this, I see this every day. I'm trying to get away from the screen.
So that was your first book, your first comparison. And you have another comparison.
I have a couple.
Okay. Show us. Take us on a journey.
So the next one, I just finished. I'm sure everyone's heard of it. It's The Marriage Portrait by Maggie O'Farrell. She wrote Hamnet. She wrote the memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am. She's one of my favorite writers, Irish writer. So this most recent book, I honestly wasn't sure if I was going to like it. It's set in 1550 Florence. And I was kind of like, okay, I mean, that's an interesting thing for you to write about. But she's so great at historical fiction. And like, just if you're someone who loves a historical detail, like this is the book for you. But the whole book basically follows this girl, Lucretia. She's become a duchess at the age of 16. Gross. The Duke Alfonso tried to marry her when she was 14 and they made him wait. Anyway, so the whole book is her basically being gaslighted by him. It's really tense. And it's like this immaculate study of the kind of terror that women faced at that time. So the book that I'm going to compare it to, even though we don't have any books set in medieval Italy, is Quiet Time by Catherine Alexandra Harvey, which is very dear to me. It was one of my editing projects. And where I've feel like there's a connection is this theme of isolation and abusive relationships. Quiet Time follows Grace. It's set in present day, and she is someone who's struggling with a lot of mental illness. She's an artist like Lucretia. Lucretia's a painter, and Grace is trying to be a writer, but her father was a writer, and he kind of took away a lot of the romanticism of writing because he showed her all his rejection letters and things like that. And she hasn't been supported. So the whole book is basically her trying to find connection, trying to find love and feeling very isolated. And it's also in a lot of ways about the ways that women are silenced by the patriarchy and silence themselves. So I feel like these books would actually be like a really interesting conversation because it's sort of like, wow, not much has changed in
not
a couple
much has
centuries.
Changed.
You know, Newfoundland, Florence, you know, different
exactly
centuries.
Exactly the same. Oh, sorry. No.
But there's so much similarity there. And Katie's just such an incredible writer. And, you know, the book is really heartbreaking, but also beautiful. And there's a lot of like folklore. I know that you had her on the podcast and that you read the book and really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And what I really liked about it is what you said is that when you think you have power and you realize you don't. And so for Grace, she thinks she has all the power in this relationship because she has in the past been a very sensual person that gets what she wants.
Yes.
And then she realizes she has no power.
Yes. Yeah. I think Quiet Time is, you know, it's not a light read, but it's a necessary one. And it's just one of those books, like talk about that feeling. Like when I read this, I cried so hard at the end. And there's this like thing that some agents say, when you cry, you buy, which is sort of like, you know, a bit cliche, but I was like, I need to work on this. Like I identified so much, you know, a lot of my own like mental health journey. I could connect with the character and I just felt like I need to know this writer because this is her first book and I just can't believe, you know, what she's done. And it's funny because I know she's working on another book now and she's like, I thought all books were going to be this hard to write. when it's very personal, there's like an emotional labor there. So, so yeah, that was like a really rewarding project to work on. And I just think everyone should read it.
So if you like, what was the first book?
The Marriage Portrait by Maggie O'Farrell, or any book about, you know, women in the patriarchy. There's a lot of them, and just like great writing. So yeah, quiet time. I've got a couple more here.
Tell us. They're excited.
Okay. Okay. So this is another one. I had like a great series of books that I read in a row recently. So I feel like I'm on a real high and I'm scared to read something else now.
That is a real fear.
It is.
You read a great book. You read another great book.
Yeah.
And you're like, if this one's bad, I may never read again.
I know. You're like waiting for that slump. And my partner actually calls, he knows when I'm between books. He sees me wandering around like a ghost and he calls it book limbo when I'm like... between books, and it's the same.
I call it unmoored. I'm just like, I don't know where I'm going or what I'm doing.
I'm not in a fictional world right now.
Like,
where am
I depressed? No, I just haven't picked
my
next book.
It is kind of depressing to leave these worlds sometimes, you know, even if they're like not great places to be, you're sort of attached to the characters. But this one was so immersive. It's called The Whalebone Theater by Joanna Quinn. You're probably sensing a bit of a theme with me, but I really love historical fiction. I love family sagas. This one is set in Chilcombe Manor on the shores of the English Channel, and it follows, get ready for this, best character name ever, Christabel Seagrave.
Does she die in the sea?
I'm not going to tell. And her siblings, they're kind of wild kids. Like their parents are, it's like 1928 and their parents are just like throwing these lavish parties and like, oh, look at the adorable children. And they're just like one running around, which I love. And they actually, the name of the book comes from this whale that beaches up on the shore, and they end up using its skeleton as like a theater to put on plays, which is like super weird, but like amazing. And then we actually follow them all the way through World War II. Christabel becomes a spy in Nazi occupied France. And it's just the writing. It's like the writing on a line level. It's so fresh. It's a big book, but it keeps you like totally hooked the whole way. And as I was reading it, I was like, I never want this book to end. It reminded me actually while I was reading a lot of a book that we published, The History of Rain by Stevens Gerard Malone. And Stevens is someone who he's just so dedicated to his craft. He takes his time and his books are quite short, you know, in relation to like maybe like a standard length. But every word is so carefully chosen. And for that reason, really, for me, it was like a little bit intimidating to edit him because I was just like, I know every word has been labored over to the sense that, you know, you can tell right away, like some authors are more about the sentence. Some of them are more about plot, but he's about every single word. So, so this book is literary historical fiction and it follows a character named Rain. And at the very beginning of the book, he's recovering in a pre-World War I army hospital in France. And he comes upon this girl, Lily, who is low class. She's, you know, selling herself. And he kind of wants to take her under his wing and care for her. But she's kind of always out of his grasp. Eventually, he becomes a gardener. He kind of learns gardening from a man that's on the grounds, and it sort of helps him recover from his injuries. Anyway, we follow him to Lily's manor where she's married to this rich man, and this man is wanting to keep Lily interested and wanting to basically keep her in this manor. And so he's tasked with creating a new garden for her it's either every night or every week, I can't remember now, but either way it's a huge production. And he ends up being scouted to go work for Hollywood. And so we kind of follow him from Europe to Hollywood, and it's very like, you know, the glamorous days of Hollywood, and he, you know, Gone with the Wind and movies like that. And so we kind of follow Rain. He's a bit of a tragic character as he's sort of trying to find connection, trying to find love. So it reminded me of the Whalebone Theater in the way that it's sort of like chasing this, what I'm calling the illusion of love. You have these characters who are kind of really affected by the war, but not really dealing with it. And you also have this upper class, lower class distinction where there's people that it's almost like the war didn't affect them. And then there's other people that are kind of like doing all the work to kind of keep their lives comfy and nice. So that's a book that, you know, kind of lives in you after you read it. Like, it's really powerful. The writing is incredible. I'm working on his next novel now, which I'm not going to say too much about, but it'll be out in fall 2023.
Does it have a title or no?
It's, well, we did announce it, and it's tentatively called Jumbo. So it's about Jumbo the elephant.
Right.
And I think it's his best work, but you will just have to wait and see. But yeah, I would definitely recommend The History of Rain. It's It's pretty incredible.
So if you liked The Whalebone Theater by Joanna Quinn.
Yes.
Then read
The History of Rain by Stephen Gerard Malone. So the next one is, you know, those sometimes a book really like haunts you and you're like, when you're done, you're just sort of like, whoa, what just happened? And then you're like, I think I loved it. I'm not sure if it was my favorite, and I wasn't sure if it would be on my favorites list, but I have not forgotten about it, and I keep coming back to it. It's called Our Wives Under the Sea by Julia Armfield. So it's stunning, it's tense, and it explores the depths of the marriage of a marriage and the depths of the ocean. And it's told in dual timelines. So we have Mira, whose wife Lee returns from a top secret deep sea mission, and she's just not the same as when she left. And it's not really a spoiler because you find out pretty soon, but their watercraft was the submarine was actually lost for quite a long period and they couldn't communicate with them. So everyone thought that they had all died. So she's thought that her wife is dead. And then they come back and she won't tell her anything about what happened down there. And they were going basically deeper than anyone has ever gone. So it's really, really tense because we know she makes it, but we don't know what happened to her. And you don't find out until very late in the book. And her behavior is very strange. When she comes back, she always wants to be in the bathtub, just like sitting there and all kinds of weird stuff.
Okay, so if you read that.
Yes, so I have another really exciting book called Some There Are Fearless by Becca Babcock. Some of you might remember Becca's book that came out in spring 2020, One Who Has Been Here Before. And similarly, this is also a contemporary novel, but this one is set in Canada and the Ukraine, and it follows a nuclear engineer who's obsessed with preventing disaster. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about it. Jessica Menchaki's life has been shaped by the threat of nuclear disaster. She's a child when she hears of the Chernobyl nuclear accident and the disappearance of Ukrainian relatives growing up on a northern Alberta military base during the Cold War. From that moment on, all she wants is to keep danger at bay. But living in a household with a domineering and volatile mother and a rebellious older brother in isolated Cold Lake, Alberta, Jessica never feels fully safe. When she comes of age, she leaves her suffocating small town for Halifax, Nova Scotia, where she meets her future husband and eventually becomes a nuclear engineer in charge of risk assessment and management at nuclear power plants. But even as she shields the world from nuclear disaster, she is constantly facing personal tragedies, like a strained marriage, a misogynistic workplace, and severe postpartum anxiety that she never quite manages to predict. When her young daughter is afflicted with a mysterious and potentially deadly illness, Jessica must learn to accept that not all risk can be managed. Beginning with the threat of the Cold War and the ripple effects of the Chernobyl nuclear accident, and punctuated by other disasters, both natural and man-made, Some There Are Fearless is an intimate and vulnerable exploration of the thin line between control and chaos.
Ooh.
So, yeah. So it's a really interesting. I keep telling Becca that she's prescient because, like, obviously this was submitted before everything was happening, you know, with Russia and Ukraine. Becca's got Ukrainian heritage. So obviously a lot of this comes from her own personal background. She grew up on a military base in Cold Lake. During the time of, you know, where they had to hide under their desks, you know, and all that stuff. So a lot of it comes from her personal life, but obviously fictional. It's kind of a deep dive into marriage and motherhood and like these universal things. But there's also this threat, this outside threat of war and like, is nuclear power safe or not? And so she is someone with like severe anxiety who tries to like manage risk as much as possible, but she's like failing in her personal life. So it's a really interesting combination. I think a lot of women can probably relate to where you feel like a superhero at work, but when you come home, you're like, oh, here's all the ways that I'm failing, you
yes,
know?
In every aspect.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, and also she's in a very male-dominated industry. So so that's part of it, too. She's always trying to prove herself. And then it's got three timelines. So we follow her growing up in Cold Lake and sort of like her coming of age and where she kind of develops a lot of her anxiety because everything with Chernobyl happens. And when you look at a map, Chernobyl is parallel to Cold Lake. So the reason why she's on this base is because they're all training for a potential nuclear attack. And so she starts to realize how close all of that is to her. And she internalizes that. Yeah, so it's a really interesting exploration of sort of like the macro and micro, like internal, external, but also I think really relatable.
Yeah, because generally when you become a parent, you have to relinquish a certain amount of control over your life. There are just things that you can no longer control as much as you would like to. Mm-hmm. So even that is just generally, I think, super relatable.
Yes. And she is a mother. And I think she kind of pulled a lot of that, you know, to write in the book. And like the whole thing about postpartum anxiety, like I know Joanne Gallant writes about that in A Womb in the Shape of a Heart. And so I was familiar with
one
that.
One of my favorite reads of
so
the year.
So good. It's, yeah, that book is everything.
Magic.
So the next one I have, I don't read a ton of nonfiction, but I absolutely loved Sarah Polley's Run Towards the Danger. And it's just a collection of personal essays that talk about her growing up as a child actor and suffering a traumatic head injury and all kinds of different things. And her doctor tells her she has to run towards the danger if she wants to cure herself. It's definitely the best work of nonfiction I've read in a long time. And the book that it made me think of, which is a book that I'm also really proud of, From Showing Off to Showing Up by Nancy Reagan. And I know she was on the podcast.
I love Nancy.
And I similarly were kind of seeing like a well-known media personality finally opening up about like the reality, like behind the camera, what was going on. And her book, which we worked on together for about 2 years, it really became like she didn't want to just talk about herself. She was very conscious of that. But I was like, you have to think about what you're giving to other people. And so when I was able to frame it that way, I think she was able to see like she's learned a lot. She's still on this journey, but she has a lot of, you know, a lot of advice to give and a lot of, you know, vulnerable stories to share that people would have no idea how much she was struggling. So I think for someone who definitely is familiar with imposter syndrome and like fear of not being enough, fear of failure, I think anyone can relate to it. And it's also just she's a really great writer. So I think, yeah, so those books would be highly recommended.
Yeah, that was one of the books that I feel changed me as a person after I read it. I was just like,
that's amazing.
Nancy, you helped me so much.
I know. I kept saying that to her all the way through. Like, you're going to help so many people, I'm telling you. And sometimes even just opening up and saying, look, I wasn't confident. This is how I really felt. Like, that is huge, even just to be able to say that. So props, Nancy.
Yeah, it's not a self-help book, but it feels like that when you read it because it helps you so much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was like, you know, a lot of she didn't want it to be a self-help book, but it's like
but it helps you. It helps the self when you read it.
You can't help but help.
you can't help but get help. Sorry, Nancy, but you're gonna help people.
You are. So the next one is When We Lost Our Heads by Heather O'Neill, who is my favorite author. I've just got to say,
I haven't read it yet. It's been sitting on my desk for a year.
It's one of the first books I read this year because it came out in February. But it's set in 19th century Montreal, and it's basically you follow these two girls from very different social classes. One of them becomes the heiress to her father's sugar factory, and the other one kind of falls into like the queer underworld, and she starts writing this like really subversive like sexual material and like literature.
Spicy.
And nobody knows who's writing it, and so it kind of follows their two lives and how they kind of come back together. And just the writing is incredible. Like, no one writes a metaphor like Heather O'Neill.
I love books that are just basically about two friends, like two female friends,
and that kind of obsessive
relationship is just like,
it's so fascinating.
Unlike anything.
I know.
You ever experience
and
in your
it's
life.
Interesting because the book that it made me think of, which is Birth Road by Michelle Wambot, who I know you're a huge fan of.
I love Birth Road.
Another project where when I read this manuscript, I was just like, how is this her first book? And when I met with her, she said no one even knew that she wrote. She had one friend who knew. And I was just like, you need to share your writing. And I'm so proud of her. And like, she just really brought it with this. But like, it really didn't need a lot from me. But I just felt like I was the person there saying, like, you're an incredible writer. And like, I can't wait for people to read this. So similarly, this book does have one of those kinds of friendships. Helen and Madge, very different social classes. But it's mostly a story about Helen, set in 20th century rural Nova Scotia. We also spend some time in Boston. And her mother works at Stanfield's Woolen Mill. And there's a lot of like industrial kind of factory work scenes in Heather's book as well. So I felt like there was a really interesting connection there. And we basically follow her through life. And she's this really interesting combination of like naive and like very perceptive. She just gets hurt over and over again. And she's like trying to find connection and love, and she's not really getting it from her family. And she ends up with this man named Edgar, who who is charming, but we know he's bad news from the beginning, and he's got a little bit of a taste for the alcohol. So yeah, it's very much a coming of age story, and we've kind of follow Helen as she develops a sense of agency over her own life. And it's just an incredible book, and it's written in these beautiful vignettes with like the best titles. Yeah, I just love like a small town story. It just kind of goes to show that everyone you see has a story, because this is based on Michelle's grandmother's life very loosely, who was named Helen.
And it has that friendship aspect too, that very interesting push and pull of female friendship and why you keep people around you, even if they hurt you.
Yes. And it's almost like the more Madge hurts Helen, the more she wants to be close to her.
Toxic friendship.
Toxic friendship. And we also, the reader always knows more than Helen does, which makes it really hard, because it's a really impactful way of writing, because we're sort of like, we're watching and we can't do anything and we just want her to be okay. But we see her making these bad decisions and having relationships with people that don't deserve her. And she's just such a good person. And she's like constantly
makes bad choices.
Yeah.
Bad stuff happens to her.
Bad stuff happens to her. But, you know, we can all relate. So if you loved When We Lost Our Heads by Heather O'Neill, you will absolutely love Birth Road by Michelle Wombolt. Yeah. So those are just like some books that I've really loved. I will also say that two of the projects that I am so proud of, Tara Thorne's Low Road Forever. I mean, I didn't read anything that I could compare to it, so I didn't list it. But like, it's because you can't compare anything to Tara.
Well, that was like one of my favorite books. It's on my list. Top. All time top. But if you love like anything by Lindy West, anything that's just like these, Sachi Cole, if you love her, books
and
essays.
Donahue, who gave us a really great blurb. She's just part of this tradition of like women telling it like it is and like kind of lifting the veil off of like exploitative like workplaces, especially as an arts journalist. So yeah, it's just amazing. And she keeps saying she's never going to write another book, but maybe if you all buy Low Road Forever and read it, then she will.
It's all those things, but then it's also just pop culture like tidbits that you want to just eat.
I know.
The essays are so good. She talks about League of Their Own. She talks about the music that shaped her.
Yes.
Alanis
a little
Moore
bit of everything. Yeah. Yeah.
Movies, all of the Hollywood stuff. So if you are a pop culture junkie, then that is the book for you.
Yes. We were just talking about 90s nostalgia. And then also Heartbreak Homes by Joe Treggiari, which I edited and absolutely love. And I don't read a lot of YA, so I didn't have a comp for it, but that would be great to read any time of the year. It's just like a great multiple point of view.
There's a book
murder
that
mystery.
Just came out now that's making the rounds on Instagram, and I think it's called The Last Party, which is a thriller about a murder that takes place at a party.
There you go.
If you like that, Heartbreak Homes is about a murder that takes part at a high school party, and it's so good, so well done. The twists are perfect.
Yes.
And you cannot predict what happens in it.
And there's also just a lot of great conversations about class and
there's a lot
gentrification,
there's a lot of deep things in
and
there.
Yeah, all of those things.
Queer joy.
Queer joy.
All things good. Well, thanks for joining me. It's
thanks
so
for having me. There's always so many books to talk about.
I know. Don't forget to buy the books. But if you can't buy the books, get them at the library. I love the library. If you're enjoying the podcast, please rate and review us. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And thank you for listening and hanging out with us. Join me next time on this book lover's journey as we try to read more, read Canadian, read local. You know, all the good things.